Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the LSE for this evening's public conversation on Brexit and the EU Global Strategy. I'm Karen Smith, and I'm a Professor of International Relations here and Director of the European Foreign Policy Unit. I'm very pleased to welcome Natalie Tolci, Ben Tanra, and Sven Biskot to the LSE. They're going to be discussing the prospects for the implementation of the EU Global Strategy following the UK referendum to exit the EU. As we have said in our publicity, undoubtedly Brexit has dealt a major blow both to the UK's role in the world and that of the EU. UK has one of the most global outlooks of the member states, of all the member states, and so the damage done by British withdrawal from the EU in terms of material capacities and reputation cannot be underestimated. However, there are also those who argue that the UK's exit from the EU would facilitate integration in security and defence. And that's one question that the panel is going to be discussing today. I have also asked them to consider the implications of a Trump, of the Trump president. no longer potential. It is a reality of a potential. Oh, no. So I did it again there. I was wishful thinking. The Trump presidency on the EU, the implementation of the EU global strategy. So what I'm going to do now is introduce each of them, and then Natalie is going to begin with her sort of understanding and of how she thinks the EU global strategy is going to be implemented post-Brexit and in Trump land. Now, Natalie is the Deputy Director of the Istituto Affari Internazionale in Rome. She's editor of the International Spectator, which is run out of the IAI, and she is a special advisor to EU High Representative for Foreign Affairs and Security Policy / Vice President of the European Commission, Federica Mogherini. As special advisor, she was in charge of outreach to think tanks and coordination of the work on the new European global strategy. She holds a PhD from here, so she is one of our own, and she has held research positions at the Center for European Policy Studies in Brussels, the Transatlantic Academy in Washington, and the Robert Schuman Center in Florence. Her research interests include European foreign policy, conflict resolution, the Middle East, and the Mediterranean, and her recent books include books on Turkey and the European Union, multilateralism in the 21st century, and the EU and conflict resolution. And in 2008, she won the Anna Lindh Award for Excellence for the Study of European Foreign Policy. Ben, on my far right, is Jean Monnet Professor ad personam of European Foreign Security and Defence Policy and Associate Professor of International Relations at the University College Dublin, School of Politics and International Relations. He holds a PhD from Trinity College Dublin, and he teaches, researches, and publishes in European Foreign Security and Defence Policy, Irish Foreign and Security Policy, and International Relations Theory. He had served as the chair of the Royal Irish Academy's Standing Committee on International Affairs, and he leads several research programs, including one that is currently meeting right now at the LSE called Antero. He's held positions at the University of Wales, Aberystwyth, Trinity College, Dublin, and the Centre for Strategic and International Studies, Washington, D.C. And a little-known fact that I did not know until this very week, he is also an American citizen born in D.C. So, my goodness. All right, then Sven, right to my right, is the director of the Europe in the World program at the Egmont Royal Institute for International Relations in Brussels and a professor at the Ghent Institute for International Studies in Ghent University. He holds a PhD from Ghent, and his research and teaching focuses on the strategies of the European Union, NATO, and their member states. He also teaches at the College of Europe in Bruges and at Louis in Rome and at the EU's European Security and Defence College, where he was recently made an honorary fellow. He co-edits Global Affairs, which is a journal of the European International Studies Association, and he edits Egmont's journal Studia Diplomatica. His latest book is called Peace Without Money, War Without Americans, Can European Strategy Cope? So this evening, we welcome all three to discuss Brexit and the European global strategy. Before we begin, please ensure that your mobile phone is on silent. But for those Twitter users in the audience, because I guess there are apparently lots of you now, the hashtag for this afternoon's talk is hashtag LSE Brexit. Yeah, it's right up there. As usual, after the lecture, there will be a chance for you to ask questions. And this, I have to remind you that this event is hopefully being recorded, and there will be hopefully a podcast available a few days hence from now. But for now, could you please welcome Natalie, Ben, and Sven.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Karen, and thank you for the invitation. It's a real pleasure to be here. Indeed, as a former student, it's an extra pleasure to be here, both student in my master's and in my PhD, so I'm very attached to this place. Okay, so let me start with the obvious question, and the obvious question being, what the hell was Federica Mogherini thinking of when she decided to circulate and publish the EU Global Strategy 48 hours after Brexit? Was this an other sign of the EU's otherworldliness, as Sven at some point put it, not arguing that this was the case? What does this mean in terms of the EU's ability to implement the strategy? Shouldn't the strategy have been rewritten altogether? So these are some of the questions which have been asked over the last months. And let me try and tell you very briefly the story of the global strategy by addressing some of these questions. And let me begin by making some observations about the context. And the underlying context, which was the one, I would say, both over the course of 2015 and of 2016 that we were operating in. And I say we, obviously, meaning the HRVP and the team I was responsible for writing the global strategy. But, of course, this is not something that you do completely on your own. You have to consult quite a few people in the process. So I would say that one of the main reasons why Federica Mogherini decided to embark on this exercise in the first place was because of the dramatically deteriorated context, both within the European Union and beyond the European Union. Over the course of 2015, when we were producing not the strategy itself, but the assessment, what we called the strategic assessment, which was basically the diagnosis before you got to the prognosis, and it was published, it was presented to the European Council back in June 2015, and was really the basis on which the tasking was given to the HRVP to produce the strategy itself. Over those months, let's say from January to June, when we were working on this first piece of work, the main storylines were all about the Ring of Fire surrounding the European Union. As you recall, Crimea had already been annexed. The Donbass was in flames. There had just been a re-eruption of the conflict in Israel-Palestine, in particular in Gaza. An Islamic State had been established in Syria and Iraq. Libya was slowly sliding back into civil war. Saudis had attacked Yemen. It was not a great world. And this was, if you like, the first part of the work that we were engaging in. Now, as we then moved into the phase two in developing the strategy itself, well, we were not only talking about external crises, we were talking about internal crises. So it was not indeed the exacerbation of many of these conflicts surrounding the European Union, but there was also the so-called, and I hate to call it a refugee crisis, it is a crisis, but it's mainly, in my view, a crisis of European values. But anyway, the so-called refugee crisis, obviously the big story about terrorism as we were drafting the global strategy, attacks in Paris and Brussels and what have you. So obviously there was this hybrid warfare being slightly sort of imported within the European Union. So there was this general growing sense of insecurity within the EU and not only beyond the EU's borders. So then the Brexit question. Does Brexit change this direction of travel? Well, actually, no, it doesn't change the direction of travel. It just simply makes a bad situation worse. But it was already, the trend was already, if you like, going from bad to worse. So in many ways, it heightened rather than reduced the need to have a strategy. And ultimately, the real message underpinning all this was really a message of unity, which became more rather than less salient following Brexit. Now, this leads me to a second sort of set of very brief observations, which has really got to do with the process. Now, I remember sending a WhatsApp message to Federica on the 24th in the morning saying, what do we do now? And she took a while to answer, I must admit. She answered by the evening. By the evening, she replied saying, we go ahead, the work is done. Now, what did she mean by the work is done? And let me just say very briefly a few words about the process. Now, the work, as I said, basically took the best part of a year, from June 2015 to June 2016. Over the course of this 1 year, we organized gatherings such as this, over 50 within the European Union, a number of meetings such as this beyond the European Union, both near Georgia, Turkey, Tunisia, Norway, and further away, the US, Brazil, Japan, Australia. So we really engaged in quite an extensive process of debate within the broader foreign policy community. Then there was the official side, monthly meetings with the Commission, monthly meetings with member states, meetings with member states at all sorts of different levels. So the strategy was discussed in the Foreign Affairs Council and the Development Council, in the informal gathering of defense ministers. It was discussed, as I said, monthly meetings with a dedicated network of points of contact from the 28 member states, but obviously then that was not enough, so it had to be discussed in the Political and Security Committee. In co-repair, it had to be discussed by security directors, by defense directors, by secretary generals of ministries of foreign affairs, and the list continues. In the end, the entire document was negotiated, although we said it was not going to be negotiated, but it was, in the end, negotiated, word by word, sentence by sentence, comma by comma. So, in short, the work was done. So this was not just a question of saying, well, we dedicated 2 years, you know, best part of 2 years doing this, and therefore we have to get it out regardless what. The main point was, underlying the sentence, the work is done, is we can actually show that we can still be united. So precisely because of Brexit, precisely because of that message of and that risk of disintegration, here we are, and we are actually able to still agree at 28, and let me underline here in London that actually the United Kingdom was a very constructive actor throughout the process of developing the global strategy. We can actually agree on something meaningful. This is a 10,000-word-odd document, and it says stuff. And therefore, there was this underlying political need to basically show that we can still do it. The work was done. So now let me focus very briefly on a third set of remarks, which is really about the content. So did the strategy have to be rewritten because of Brexit? And some suggested, surely this can't make sense. You know, if you lose a member state like the United Kingdom, how could you possibly not rewrite the entire document? Now, for those of you that saw the strategy, you will see that basically it has a set of fairly straightforward messages. It starts off by saying what the EU's interests are in security, prosperity, democracy, a rules-based global order. It says what the principles of the EU are, principles of engagement, of responsibility, of unity, of partnership. It sets out five main priorities for the Union, the security of the Union, resilience of states and societies to our east and our south, a more integrated approach to conflicts and crises, cooperative regional orders in different world regions, and in a sense a more transformative approach to global governance. Now, does any of that change without the UK? Does it mean that the EU should actually aim for different goals without the United Kingdom? And of course the answer to that question is no. It doesn't. The goals remain precisely the same. But then there is a deeper set of issues. As I said, this is a document which was ultimately negotiated between 28 member states. So the deeper question of should anything have been rewritten with Brexit in mind, the deeper question is on what issues was the UK the outlier? And actually, the UK, is connected to the remarks I was making earlier about the UK having been a constructive actor in this process, the truth is that actually the UK is an outlier only on a very, very few and very specific issues. On most other issues, there are far bigger problems within the European Union than the British position. And And also, you know, sort of to highlight the fact that as we were working on this, and we were basically writing this document, I was writing this document in the first months of 2016, and this was an indication that the HRVP gave to me very specifically. She said to me, reread every sentence you write, thinking whether it makes sense with or without a Brexit. The other thing she asked me, sounds a bit kind of ominous now, was reread it thinking whether it makes sense with a Trump presidency. And, you know, I very diligently did what she asked me to do. So at the end, you know, on the morning of the 24th, I asked myself, so what is it I have to really change here? Now, of course, there was a bit of a change in terms of the political messaging. So the whole story of unity got bumped up in the narrative. Not so much, if you like, a statement of fact, but rather a statement of what we should be doing rather than what we are doing. And, you know, maybe a few nuances on European defence, and I'll come to this later on. But basically, you know, it was words here and there. There were no big changes to be made. And so let me now sort of move to a very final set of remarks, which is really about the follow-up. So what's happened since June 23rd, or rather June 25th, when we ultimately published the global strategy. Now, one of the calls that was made consistently right from the beginning when we started this work was, this has to be actionable. Now, this was very different from the work that Javier Solana did when he produced, thanks to Robert sitting back there, when he produced the European Security Strategy. That was not meant to be an actionable doctrine strategy. It was more meant to be a sort of doctrine, document. And in fact, I remember that when the European Council, which ultimately endorsed the European Security Strategy, tasked basically Solana to follow through on the implementation. Basically, Solana didn't actually think it was a very good idea to sort of transform it into an actionable document. Now, the situation, the political context was very different when we started working on the EU Global Strategy, and my reading of it is that the call for it to be actionable was because, whereas back in the early 2000s, basically things were going pretty well. So there was no real need to change the action. We thought that we were doing fine. It was a question of improving and enhancing. It wasn't a question of kind of, you know, revolutionizing anything. Now, of course, that wasn't the impression one had in 2015, 2016. So there was a much greater call for, indeed, the document to be actionable. Now, a strategy in and of itself is not immediately actionable. The point is whether it then leads to a process, which indeed then leads to the action. And the HRVP took up on sort of this call, and immediately, already in July, we started preparing the action. Now, a point that she made and she keeps on making repeatedly, and it came out also in the October conclusions of the Foreign Affairs Council, is that it is not just security and defence that has to be actionable. It's the entire EU global strategy. And I must say that particularly over the course of September and October, there was quite a lot of work that behind the scenes took place, particularly with the European Commission, not on the security and defence side of things, but on other priorities. I would say mainly at this point on resilience, which we finally managed to squeeze into the Commission work programme for 2017, which was very important for us because ultimately this is where lots of the tools and instruments actually lie. Just to highlight the point that it's not just, as I said, security and defence, but it's a lot about security and defence. And it's a lot about security and defence because, indeed, of the context that we're living in. And, as I said, a sort of Trump presidency highlights this situation incredibly. And the work on the implementation on security and defence started pretty much immediately. So it started over the course of August, basically. And last Monday, we finally got to our implementation plan on security and defence, which was accepted by the Foreign Affairs Council that met in its defence configuration. I would say, and I realize I'm maybe slightly biased in this because, the role that I had in this, but I actually do genuinely think, and I'd be interested to hear what both Sven and Ben think about this, and I'll end here, that this is actually quite a revolutionary step forward in terms of the common security and defense policy, to the extent that revolutions are possible in the EU, so it's all relative. But it is a major step forward, I think, in the development of CSDP, and I am convinced that this is not due to Brexit. I don't think that Brexit has made an enormous amount of difference to this. I do actually think that the election of Donald Trump is really what changed the atmosphere amongst member states, particularly those member states that think NATO first and NATO last, and NATO throughout, to those thinking, well, maybe it's best to hedge our bets here and have Europeans actually toughen up on security and defense. Now, is this going to save the European project? No, I'm afraid it won't. But to the extent that foreign policy can make a contribution to the European project, then I think and I hope that we're giving it our best shot. And I'll stop there.
Great. Thanks very much. All right. So now... Shall we start with Sven? Would you like... Or I'm putting you on the spot.
Okay. Thank you. I'm Belgian, which is why I came directly from Paris to this conference. And in Paris, I was attending the Franco-British Defense Conference. As an honorary Brit or an honorary Frenchman, it was not entirely clear. Or as a Belgian voice of reason, which sounds a bit scary, maybe. But what struck me was that all the officials at this event tried to pretend that in spite of the Brexit and Trump, we're still in business as usual, starting with the two defense ministers who opened this. Minister Fallon tried to do this by going on at length, summing up all the good examples of Franco-British cooperation and the continuing British commitment to European security. The French defense minister, Le Drian, did this by keeping it very, very short and running away immediately after his speech had ended so that nobody could ask him anything else, which perhaps betrays some... underlying differences there. Luckily, neither convinced the audience, I think, that we really are in business as usual. I say luckily because I don't think we are, and we better think a bit creatively. So maybe two sets of questions for you, Natalie, for the debate. One on defense first, and then maybe on diplomacy. On defense, and we didn't have a chance to discuss this yet since the implementation plan was adopted on Monday, I guess I'm not wrong when I had the impression that this was almost more difficult to negotiate than the actual strategy. At some point, it seemed to be very, very tricky, and having been able to follow it a bit, once we have to translate it into action, it becomes more difficult to convince member states. And indeed, I had the feeling also that it was the announcement of Trump's victory that re-dynamized the debate somewhat. But still, if I read the implementation plan, my question still is, which member states are really willing to do what and to pay for it? We've seen a flurry of proposals ever since the EUGS was published on defense specifically. We even have two Franco-German proposals, then a Franco-German-Spanish-Italian proposal with lots of ideas. But still, I'm not convinced that any of these, specifically these four, that they really want to do it. And I mean, what I think they should do is to make the leap from defense cooperation to defense integration. Cooperation means that you arrange yourself so you're interoperable with everybody, you can cooperate with everybody on an ad hoc basis. Integration means that in certain areas you begin to insert your defense capabilities in permanent multinational structures, I think, which is a leap forward, but which would really allow us to do more with our defense budget. One way of doing this would be to activate permanent structured cooperation. It is on the table, but we still don't know. And I put a question at this conference in Paris and tellingly got no answer from the French. Will you do it? Do you really want to do it? Or are you just just talking about it. So, as always, I remain optimistic, because that's just me. In spite of all the odds, I will be an optimist. I do notice that there are now deadlines in the action plan, implementation plan, quite sharp deadlines that I deadlines that I hope will keep the dynamic going, that will force member states to come up with ideas. But I still have to see it. Also because my feeling is that because member states were not so willing and they didn't want any explicit reference to a higher level of ambition, you know, which amount of troops should we be able to deploy, if necessary alone, you know, at which scale do we see ourselves as a security contributor, that to some extent the document is a bit backward looking. You know, it's looking at what we have already and building on the current level of ambition. Of course, you have to start from there. That makes sense. But if you only do that, then you're making the inventory rather than setting a level of ambition. And my feeling is that the existing level of ambition is not enough, with the existing level being to be able to deploy 60,000 troops. Europe can actually do that. If you count up all the troops that are deployed today under the EU flag, the NATO flag, the UN flag, the national flag, you easily arrive at a couple of 10,000. But you can only do it because the Americans support us. So if we say in the global strategy that now we need strategic autonomy, that in itself means you need to enhance the level of ambition, because you need your own strategic enablers, intelligence, transport, command and control, and your own reserves. And still I don't see the will on the part of the member states to do it. And of course the EU can only facilitate, I think, because it's member states' forces. That's my first set of questions. Second set on diplomacy. And for me this is in a way more challenging, also thinking of the Brexit, because when it comes in military terms, I mean, the UK will still be in Europe, and I assume that if there is a challenge that we decide to respond to militarily, because it threatens Europe, it therefore also threatens the UK, and that the UK will therefore be a part of that military intervention. And that we will choose the arrangement that best suited to the crisis at hand, through the EU, through NATO, ad hoc, what have you. My only fear is that the UK will be so preoccupied with negotiating the Brexit that Britain itself will no longer play a very active role in initiating that response. But I'm positive they will still join in if it is initiated. But what about the bigger foreign policy picture? Because I've heard the words bedrock and NATO about 20 times this morning at the conference by every British participant, but NATO in the end does not make foreign policy. NATO, if you think about it, is just a tool. It's an instrument. But the foreign policy is made elsewhere. If and when we make foreign policy together, you can only do that through the European Union, right? And it's EU decisions that very often shape the circumstances in which we deploy the military instrument, if we decide to use it. And even NATO deployments, right? NATO is now all about forward presence in the Baltic states, the very high readiness joint task force, the readiness action plan. All of that is just implementation of a bigger policy, an answer to a bigger question about what's our long-term relationship with Russia, what's our long-term relationship with Ukraine, that we decide through the EU. And just this part of implementation is delegated, if you want, through NATO. Just like a big part of the diplomacy is probably delegated to Angela Merkel and François Hollande, I should say, there's anybody French in the audience. and then the EU itself does the whole sanctions bit, right? So if the UK cuts itself loose from this foreign policy making forum, where does that leave both sides? I think it weakens the EU because you lose an important diplomatic player, but it also weakens the UK because, yes, it will still be NATO, but NATO is only the one who implements. You know, it's a bit like Australia and New Zealand in NATO today. They're great troop contributors, but they don't have much of a say in foreign policy. And I don't think a special relationship with Donald Trump is very appealing, to be honest. So I don't see there are many alternatives. So what kind of arrangements can we imagine to keep the United Kingdom involved in EU foreign policy making? And I hope that the answer will not be more informal contact groups. I have to say that because our institute is funded by the Belgian Foreign Ministry, which doesn't like informal contact groups. Voilà, His Majesty is satisfied now. I mean, His Majesty, the King of the Belgians. But also because in the end, ad hocery will not do it, right? You need not just the decision maker, you also need the tools of the EU. And final question linked to this, bringing in Donald Trump again. Whatever happens, I think the EU will have to up its diplomatic game, whether Trump chooses a more isolationist foreign policy or whether he chooses a more activist foreign policy, in which case he'll probably start and do all kinds of stuff that we don't like. Which means, I think, that Europe will need to become a lot more proactive on the foreign policy field. And a bit paradoxically, actually, I find that the global strategy is a lot more explicit about defense than it is about diplomacy, even though there are interesting sentences here and there. For example, the global strategy says we really ought to have a strategic dialogue between Iran and the Gulf countries. I absolutely agree. I think the EU is probably best placed to start it. I don't think Donald Trump is going to start this kind of dialogue. He's perhaps rather keen to unravel the deal with Iran. But so, is Europe ready to wage this kind of much more proactive foreign policy? The Gulf region is one example. I think the triangle China-Russia-Europe is another one. How do we engage with them and make sure that we don't, to say that Russia and China do not get too close to each other? Are we ready to play that role?
Great. Natalie, would you like to respond to that?
Whatever works.
Should we do it, or we could add in Ben's voice and then maybe come back to you and then we'll open it up. Mm-hmm. All right.
Okay.
Well, I may be oversensitive on the Brexit question, coming from your nearest island, where Brexit poses to the Irish government huge strategic and tactical challenges. So, as I say, I may be oversensitized to the Brexit question, but I do think that Brexit matters to European Union foreign policy. It matters in a tactical sense, in as much as we will have less military capacity than we did. We will have less international weight than we did. And I think we've also taken a reputational knock in terms of, you know, third parties looking at a European Union that sees members floating away and debates in other member states about membership and about various other kinds of exit of those member states. So tactically, I think Brexit matters. Strategically, though, I think context is everything. And I think the document, to my reading, was both a literary document but also a very effective policy document. It very effectively set out for the first time specific interests, values, modalities and principles which now can be seen and illustrated as really underpinning what has the potential to be a more coherent and a more effective foreign policy on the part of the European Union. But, as I say, context matters. And I think context matters in a couple of respects. First of all, I think context matters internally, because the context of British withdrawal from the European Union really does destabilize what we understood was the natural weight and tension of various constituencies within the construction of EU foreign policy. Certainly, in my own lectures, my own and talking to students, you know, you always talked about the Anglo-French dynamic. It was the Atlanticists versus the Gaullists, and the Atlanticists and Gaullists carried along and ebbed and flowed between them. And you had this wonderful resolution of Saint-Malo, and we got the Common Security Defence Policy thereafter. And the Germans sort of intervened periodically on one side or the other of that fundamental, almost primal debate within Europe. Absent the UK, what happens to that internal debate? What is the new balance? Where are the leaders? You know, we tend to assume that it will be France and Germany, but Germany has played a very odd, I wouldn't say peripheral role, but a very odd role in terms of its actual weight and capacity, leaving, as I say, to this Anglo-French dynamic. Certainly in the context of Donald Trump, you know, one of my first and initial reactions was that Angela Merkel is now the leader of the free world. Both in her response to the Trump election and also in her response to the migration crisis. So for me, the first question, I suppose, is what does British withdrawal do to the internal debate within the European Union in terms of security, defence and foreign policy more broadly? There's a second internal context, which I think also matters, and that is, and one of the things that that the High Representative was very strong about, even before the strategy was formally launched, was this issue of unity. You know, no free riders, no lone rangers was one of the phrases that I recall from an early presentation. Absent the UK with a destabilized internal dynamic, what do we look at in terms of Poland, in terms of Estonia, in terms of Bulgaria, in terms of Hungary, in terms of Greece? You know, again, that internal dynamic, that internal balance that we've lived with for these nigh on number of decades has changed, and I'm curious to get a sense of where you think that balance reestablishes itself. So that's the internal context. The external context, of course, is blown wide open. The election of Donald Trump, we don't know what it means. We can't know what it means. I don't think he knows what it means. And I don't say that because I voted for Hillary Clinton and my vote went into the 97.3% of people in the District of Columbia who voted for Hillary Clinton, so it was a useless exercise on my part. But I say it because if you look at the people that he talks to on these issues, if you look at the people he surrounded himself on these issues, they are such a spectrum. And you look what he himself has said, and there is no pattern that you can logically identify. I mean, as social scientists, our job is to identify patterns. You look at what he has said, you look at the people he's talking to, there is no pattern that's identifiable. On one day, he's an out-and-out American-first isolationist, and on the other day, he's riding into whatever situation he likes, you know, abrogating international law, abrogating international treaties, and doing whatever needs to be done to get the job done that only he can do. And you genuinely don't know what that means. So that in a sense, that external context is thrown on its head. You look at the environment agreements now, and now we look to China for leadership on the environment. We look to China to defend the Paris Accords. An extraordinary turnaround in terms of what we understood the international system to be. So that external context in terms of where a Trump administration might or might not go, the vacuum that potentially creates for the European Union in terms of the Atlantic Alliance is potentially mind-boggling. He has characterized the NATO alliance as, in business terms, as a transactional relationship. We defend you because you pay us. Now, we've had how many decades of arguing about burden sharing in the Atlantic Alliance? And now Trump is saying, you know, unless you put your hand in your pocket and prove to me you're putting 2% of GDP in, I'm not going to defend you. You know, that kind of transactional defense alliance is in, you know, normal terms called racketeering. That's not how you structure an alliance. That's not how you share values. That's not how you defend those values. So with Trump pulling that carpet out from under so many of our established understandings and truths, I wonder and I fear in terms of what is the European response to that. Now, on the one hand, one might make the argument that what this is going to do is going to force the Europeans to get their act together. In other words, we've talked about burden sharing and it never happened. We've talked about a balanced alliance, it never happened. Trump, in a sense, forces us to make that happen. And in a sense, you see glimmers of this, I think, in terms of what I find to be very unfortunate references to European armies and military headquarters, etc., that came up after the Trump election. But to be fair, the HRVP, even before the strategy was launched, was saying that in the area of security defense, there was a lot that could be done, a lot that would deliver to European citizens in terms of security defense they were looking for. So I don't know that the more recent proposals presage anything fundamentally new, but my question is the extent to which Donald's pulling the rug out from under the rest of the world, whether that leads the Europeans really to get their act together and move forward more collectively. On the other hand, however, there is also the visible danger that having pulled that rug out, that the Europeans, we don't get our act together. And that, to me, is the more plausible and the more frightening scenario. Particularly when you see what has gone on with the Russian Federation over the last 2 or 3 years, when you see what has happened in Hungary, when you see what is happening in Poland, when you see the insecurity in the Baltics, when you see I don't think it's likely, but nonetheless, the prospect of a Front National victory in the French presidential elections and the role of the Russian Federation and Russian public diplomacy in many different member states supporting many different political parties. That external context potentially makes a mockery of the unity that the strategy put forward as being an essential goal of the entire project. So with that external context so very different, with the internal context destabilizing established balances, the question to my mind is, you know, is there the will visibly within the Union with, one would hope, something called leadership coming from Germany? Do we have the wherewithal really to deal with those contextual challenges, both of the internal variety and the external variety?
Yeah, if I could one of the things that I've been thinking about is trying to put myself in a neo-realist's shoes. And, of course, you could have these external threats. One could unify against them, but they can also rip you to shreds as states bandwagon or attempt to cozy up to the source of the threat, which could be either the Russian threat or some sort of putative American threat. And, you know, thinking about the balance between the Atlanticists and the Europeanists within that, what are the Atlanticists going to do? You can see how both that internal and external context could, yes, bring unity, and maybe we're seeing a honeymoon now, but maybe this is the, you know, 1939, and we're seeing something about to, the night rather than the day, as it were. So anyway, over to you, Natalie.
Okay, so let me begin with Sven and time. And, you know, was it more difficult to negotiate this more actionable bit on security and defence than the global strategy? Yes, in some ways, yes. What's the reason for that? I think the reason for it is also that one took 1 year, the other took 2 months. So we really rushed it. Huh? And why is it that we rushed it? We rushed it because we know we don't have time. We know that window of opportunity, that window of political opportunity which exists today, come March, is closed. So we need to do as much as possible now, and we need to, in a sense, concentrate as much as possible on the practical stuff. And yes, you're right, you know, the right way of doing it is probably figuring out exactly how many troops you need and, you know, your level. That would have taken a long time. I'm not saying that it shouldn't be done. And in a way, you're right, one is, in some respects, putting the cart before the horse. But in a sense, we don't have that time. So to the extent that we can get stuff done now, we should try and get as much possible done now. Which are the member states willing to actually do these things? And, you know, who are really the ambitious ones? Now, I think that, you know, we're not only talking about the French and the Germans and the Spanish and the Italians. I think we're talking about the Finns. We're talking about, in many respects, the Baltic countries. We're talking about, I would add, the Czech Republic. I would add Slovakia. In some respects, possibly even Greece. I think, actually, there's the list is not short. It's not 28 or even 27 member states, but it's not just four or five. The Netherlands, Belgium, Luxembourg, I mean, I would put it at around 13 to 15 member states. So this leads to the PESCO question. We're talking about a PESCO, for those that are not aware, not acquainted, PESCO is a permanent structured cooperation, which is basically a group of member states deciding to press the accelerator on deeper defence cooperation and possibly integration, as Sven was saying. A PESCO of about 15 member states is a fairly big PESCO. Which probably means that given that the states that we're talking about, they may be more ambitious, which is not, does not necessarily mean that they're all ambitious in the same way, meaning not to the same extent, but literally what they mean by ambition. They may want slightly different things, so you need to somehow concoct a group of member states that wants to move forward that allows sufficient modularity and differentiation within this group of front runners. And I think this is going to be the challenge, because of course if you then try and narrow it down too much, then you kill it off. You know, you can't have a PESCO of four member states, the others will just kill it. So you need to somehow be smart about the way you go about this. On the question about the bigger sort of foreign policy picture and the Brexit effect on that, well, the thing is, we don't really know. And the truth is that Brexit hasn't actually happened. And yes, we hear that Brexit means Brexit. We've been hearing that since July. We haven't heard much about what that actually means. So we're here waiting, and it could take quite a long time. I must say that up until now, the Brexit madness doesn't seem to have polluted foreign policy yet. And I think this came through in some of the things that I was saying earlier about the attitude of the United Kingdom on these questions over the last 5 months. We don't know how that negotiate, if and when it starts, how it's going to go. But it's not inconceivable that actually foreign policy, as opposed to, if you like, the sort of economic questions, you know, sort of single market related questions, where the bargaining power is much more unbalanced. On foreign policy, it's far, I wouldn't say it's completely equal, but, you know, it's far more balanced. So if rationality prevails and if the rest of the madness doesn't contaminate foreign policy, which is a huge question mark, then it's not inconceivable that the UK could actually be associated with not only on security and defence, but possibly even on the other aspects of external action, if you like, more broadly construed. On the context questions, inside and out, as I said, you know, given that we're not talking about Brexit today or next year or the year after, actually, and, you know, yes, clearly if and when that happens, it's going to have a huge impact, but it's hugely difficult to imagine what that impact is going to be on the rest when the rest is changing so dramatically. I mean, if next year we have Marine Le Pen in France, well, is that more or less cataclysmic than Brexit? Arguably, in many respects, given the role that France and Germany have played in the European construction, if you like, in the European project, arguably more. So I just find it incredibly difficult to, in a sense, foresee in that respect. And therefore, all you can do today, and I appreciate this will come across as being incredibly sort of short-termist and perhaps superficial, but all you can do is simply keep on assuming that, well, this is the situation today. And so I just, you know, one can only try and sort of think through policy in terms of the balances that you have today, because thinking through the balances of tomorrow is, you know, what if Renzi loses the referendum in 2 weeks, you know, 3 weeks' time? What if, you know, we just don't know. We just don't know.
He's going to stay regardless.
Yes, I agree. I think he will probably have a nice technical government that he can shoot down for a year and be a good old populist and then try and win elections. Anyway, I shouldn't have said that, so, podcast, but anyway. Never mind. So on the internal context, who knows? On the external context, we don't know either, do we? So, yes, I mean, Trump could mean either of two things. You know, you could have an isolationist Trump, you can have an interventionist Trump. I agree with Sven. In both hypotheses, it means potential trouble for the Europeans. As I said, as of now, what is it today, the 20 what of November? As of now, one can say that the first signals are we've got to get our act together. And the question then is, are we going to be able to get our act together? So on the, you know, is it going to lead to bandwagoning or not? I see it more as a, if I were to, at this point, bet my money, either one way or another, I think in terms of political will, it will increase incentives to get our act together. Where I'm far more skeptical is our ability to get our act together on time, given that external context is changing so dramatically. And, you know, and it's not just about defence, but if we just take the defence example, you know, to build some of these capabilities takes years, it takes decades at times, you know, and that context is changing pretty fast. So are we going to, even if the political will is there, so even in the optimistic sort of, you know, Sven world, are we going to have the time to get our act together is where I'm more skeptical, and I finish where I started, which is the reason why we have to hurry up so much.
Okay, great. Thanks very much. All right, we've got now, shall I open it? I'm going to open it up to some questions from the audience. We have roving mics. If you could please keep your questions very short, I'm going to take groups of three, and I'm going to privilege people who look like they are students first. So look young, everybody. The checked shirt in the front.
Hi, thank you. I'm not a student here from Germany, but I would do like to ask a question. I know you've been talking about the global strategy and Brexit and so on, but I was feeling then that maybe my feeling generally for all of you speaking was that you spoke quite a lot of how to react to Brexit, how to react to Trump, but you were speaking quite little only about why actually Brexit happened and why Trump came to power and about the internal problems the US is facing right now. You mentioned that right-wing parties coming to the rise, but my feeling is that's one of the biggest challenges for the EU, not just globally, but also internally, and that's actually the first thing that we should have to address. And I think I would like to know what you think about that.
Okay, there's a woman at the back with, she's got her hand up right now.
Hi, thank you. I probably still look like a student, so I'm just going to go with that. I wanted to ask about possible association formats for the UK, and I know that that's tea leaf reading perhaps at this point, but I wanted to ask quite specifically Natalie, because I know that you've done some research on Turkey way back then, and you brought up this idea of a virtual veto and a privileged partnership, and how far do you think that that might be applicable to the UK once we get to it?
Thank you. My question is, what kind of relationship can we expect between Britain and the EU once the Brexit has been established? Is there going to be a sort of close relationship, or are we going to see some sort of a distancing to satisfy the popular vote after the referendum?
We're going to be deepening the channel. Great. All right, so we'll just take this round of three, and I think if we can go in the order that you spoke, since I think all three of you could have something to say, and then we'll take other questions as well.
Okay, so I think on the incredibly important question of why it happened, and of course, you know, there are lots of differences, but I think there is obviously a constant here, which is emerging. And, you know, it's clear that we're living in times of, you know, a backlash against globalization, against integration, interdependence. The reasons for that are indeed all of the excesses that it produced and the inequality. And I don't have to recite this. I think in a sense, the analysis, yes, is there. Of course, there is a major problem here. And the major problem is that the European Union is, by definition, an integration project. It's, by definition, a project based on interdependence. So what can the European Union do about those underlying causes, given that, in a sense, it's aiming at its very nature? I don't have an answer, to be honest, to that question. What I do know is that it is a question which is being asked. But I think if nation states have a problem answering that question, or rather the only answer that they give is closure, then obviously that by definition cannot be the answer that which is provided by the European Union because of its very nature. So in a sense, I'm not quite sure. I mean, this may sound a bit sort of de-responsabilizing the European Union, but I'm not even sure the EU can provide an answer to that because, by definition, it's on one side of the argument. It can indeed, and I think it should, try and develop policies, and, you know, this is taking us further, you know, sort of further away from foreign policy, but not necessarily. But obviously it should develop policies and pursue policies that actually make a difference to citizens. And actually I was saying this would take us slightly away from foreign policy, but I'm wrong, because actually security is one thing that citizens actually care about quite a lot. If one could show that actually the EU does make a difference to people's citizens, to citizen security, and a narrative could be constructed around that, that could be a big asset. Maybe because I'm Italian, I think that the economy is ultimately what's going to make the trick, either one way or another, probably more than security, but probably if you sit in the Baltics or elsewhere, you don't think the same. So I think there is something that the EU can do, but it, by definition, is, as I said, on one side of a divide on this one. On the Turkey-UK question, I always thought about it the other way around. So I always thought about it in terms of, you know, the relationship the United Kingdom would develop with the European Union could end up being a model for Turkey. I must admit that given the ways and the way things are looking like in the United Kingdom in terms of its relationship, future relationship with the European Union, but also unfortunately the way things are going in Turkey, yes, maybe there is a model there, but it's not exactly the model I was thinking of. Let me just put it that way.
Did you want to say anything about what you think, though?
No.
Okay, great. All right, Sven.
On the first question, I'll give the very classic leftist answer. I think the EU lost voters because of its neoliberal reply to the economic and financial crisis and created the impression that it's a banking union meant to save the system, save the euro, regardless of the cost to Europeans, and you have to turn that around. That means, I think, at least in the Eurozone, not just, of course, further harmonizing economic policies, but also harmonizing fiscal policies, but of course in the right way, and beginning with a European social policy. There are ideas on the table, but it goes horribly slowly. And for a while, after the Brexit, everybody became socialist, and I heard so many people say we need to understand the signal of the people. I heard the Belgian foreign minister say, who was very far from being a socialist, that the answer to this was European social policy. European minimum wage is what he mentioned. Now, we once had a chairman of the Flemish Socialist Party who said basically everybody is a socialist, but not everybody knows it. So yeah. People are finally discovering this. So in my view, this is where we need to look for the answer. And I do think that this commission understood this and tries to slowly change the course of the tanker, but it goes very, very slowly. On the future status of the UK, I remember a meeting which Richard Whitman actually organized in Chatham House about this, where everybody was extremely pragmatic. But also lots of people said the danger is, though, that there will be collateral damage from the overall Brexit debate. And if this goes awry, nothing of what we all think pragmatically should happen on foreign policy and security will happen if it goes awry. And there are sort of conflicting tendencies, you know. This morning at the conference again, someone mentioned the idea that there would be some special relationship between the UK and the EU. But I also remember I wrote something in a very early policy brief, something like that. And I remember getting an email from a military friend from another country who said, special relationship? They should come begging on their knees. We're not going to give them a seat just for free. So you see how there's, on the one hand, the realization, of course, we need to involve the United Kingdom in foreign and security policy. On the other hand, there's sort of the feeling they chose to leave. It's sort of up to them to come and ask for something, not sort of up to us to say, please, will you stay a little bit? So I can see all the reasons why, but it's going to be difficult to do that.
Yeah, if I could just add on that. I mean, one issue, of course, is the interconnectedness of foreign policy. I mean, you can't just say it's only CFSP, so that any kind of relationship only on CFSP is going to be satisfactory. There are links. There's sanctions and aid and all sorts of things. And once you open that can of worms, how could there be? What shape of a relationship could there be? Just limiting it to declarations? I mean, that doesn't quite seem. It seems very difficult to me. But anyway, Ben.
Yeah, I mean, the first question, I mean, there is no more important question. I mean, we're invited to speak to a question. That doesn't mean that's the most important question at the moment, but your question is the most important question. And for me, I mean, the kind of international relations that I do is about how certain stories, how certain narratives of the way the world works are constructed. And one of the most effective narrative constructions over the last 10 to 15 years is one which has constructed the European Union as the source of insecurity rather than security. Europe as the source of insecurity through migration. Europe as the source of insecurity in terms of the economy. I come from a country that escaped the Troika in the last number of years. Within the Troika, the European Central Bank and the European Commission were the bad guys. The people who were on our side was the IMF. Now, for a country that has a very long history of being pro-European, that was something of a shock. And you see, through austerity driven by a particular political model, etc., you can very easily see how the European Union has been characterized as the problem, as the source of the insecurity. To my mind, the only way the European Union gets over that is a volte-face in terms of the way in which it delivers policies and the kinds of policies it delivers. Whether it has the political capacity and the member states... We've been having the debate for a long time. I mean, France and Italy have been making the counter-argument to the orthodoxy for some time, and we weren't listening. If we get that fundamental change in policy, perhaps then the European Union can begin to build itself out of that, and maybe on the security and migration front, we can start to deal with that, again, in concert with the values that we're supposed to represent. That, to me, is the key. I mean, one can imagine, because we're dealing with nightmare scenarios on so many fronts, we can imagine a nightmare scenario where the European Union set itself up as Fortress Europe, where Frontex was used in a very bad way in terms of dealing with migration. I don't think that will happen, but that would be another response were the Le Pens and the Orbans and the others to really take control of the European project themselves. I have obviously no comment on the Turkey question. On the EU-UK question... Again, we don't know. I'm far enough away and yet close enough that I think I can offer a view on British foreign policy, at least in the sense of seeing a British foreign policy today unmoored, unattached, floating in a sort of ambiguous way that I don't know that British foreign policymakers know where they're going. I mean, I know that from the pro-Brexit side, there is a vision of an Elizabethan Britain setting forth on the high seas of international society and doing great things. And I can see the attractiveness of that model. But where is the port? You know, where is that galleon going to sail? Where is it going to find landfall? I don't think there are a lot of places for an unhinged British foreign policy to go. But to echo Sven's point, that's a matter for the UK. You know, if the UK wants to cut itself off, it's free to cut itself off. If it wants to have a relationship with the European Union, it will have to come to the European Union and say, we want a relationship.
Great. All right. We can have another round of questions. I'll start on this side again. The gentleman with the jacket right there.
Thank you very much. In the global strategy, it talks about principled pragmatism. It sounds oxymoronic. What does it actually mean, and do you foresee this being a potential approach for ongoing defence cooperation with Britain and for Brexit negotiations?
Okay, great. Right in the middle.
Thanks a lot. I'd like to come back for a second to Ben's comment. And please correct me if I'm wrong, if I'm sort of misinterpreting this, but it sounded like you were wishing for German leadership. Now, to me, it seems that this is sort of a bit sort of in contradiction, really, to Sven's comment, who was saying, you know, everybody's pushing for austerity these days. So my question then would be to all of you, is Europe ready for German leadership? Now, I have serious concerns that Germany is willing to assume this leadership, but would Europe be ready? Thank you.
And then, right.
My name is Paula, and we were talking about the different groups of states which are more willing to go forward towards the foreign policy of the European Union and also to the integration of the European Union. So should we start thinking seriously about the multi-speed Europe and how it should look like?
All right. Mm-hmm. Should we go in the same order as... Okay.
Okay, so principled pragmatism. I'm very personally attached to this topic, as you can imagine. So what it does not mean and what it does mean. What it does not mean, and I'm very attached to this too, what it does not mean is that the EU should compromise on its principles because of pragmatic considerations. This is not what it should mean. This is the reason why we basically wanted to get out of this values, interest values debate, where basically, you know, in EU talk, you talk about both. In fact, you tend to talk more about values than about interests. Everyone feels more comfortable talking about values than interests, but everyone feels far more comfortable in doing interests rather than values. So that's basically been the story. This has been the academic debate. What we wanted to do is to move away from this. So what you'll notice in the strategy, we only talk about interests, but we talk about interests in a way which makes it obvious that we're also talking about values. So what does principled pragmatism mean if it does not mean compromising on principles? What it means is that in the EU's assessment of the world, it should be pragmatic. It should be a pragmatic assessment of the world. So you don't assume that you have a ring of countries that want to end up entering and becoming like and looking like the European Union. Some do, and we shouldn't forget about those. So we shouldn't be forgetting about countries in the Western Balkans, about some of the countries in the Eastern Partnership in particular. But the truth is that the rest actually don't at all. So we have to be pragmatic about it. We don't live in the world that we lived in or we thought we lived in the 1990s and the early 2000s. So that's where the pragmatism comes in the assessment. The principles come in the way in which we approach that reality. And one thing which I liked very much about the strategy was, for example, in the way in which we talk about democracy as an interest. And we talk about democracy not in terms of what we should be imposing on others. We never use the term democratization or democracy promotion. We talk about democracy when actually talking about the way in which we have to conduct our own foreign policy, meaning we have to live up to our own democratic values when conducting foreign policy, which means that we have to live up to the respect for international law, including human rights law, including all of these things. And it's not because of what we project onto others. It is about who we are. So that's where the principles come in. The principles are about living up to who you are. Now, of course, there's a subliminal message here, because the truth is that actually, as Europeans, internally, we don't live up to those values always. I don't need to name names of member states, but you could imagine that we had quite a few arguments about this point with several of them at this point, because indeed, some of these values are being questioned on the inside. And so the argument that we're making is, before preaching to others, let's do our homework on the inside, because actually it cannot and it is not being taken for granted any longer. Is the EU ready for German leadership? Well, to be honest, it's not that ideal, really, is it? I mean, the European construction was actually, it started as a way of containing Germany. And what does this mean to the European project if you have this complete reversal of the situation? I think actually that Germans themselves don't feel particularly comfortable about this either. And I think that no one else feels particularly comfortable about this. The point is, can something be done about it? Because it's not so much a question of German leadership, it's more a question of the weakness of everyone else at this point in time. Now, can Germany do something about that? Yes, I think it can. But this goes back to the points that you were making earlier, I think, Ben. On the question of multi-speed, are we moving towards a multi-speed EU? Well, in a sense, there has been a multi-speed EU for quite some time. I would say that now we're moving towards a multi-level rather than a multi-speed EU. I mean, a multi-speed suggests the fact that sooner or later everyone's going to get to the Holy Land. So there will be different speeds, but everyone will ultimately get to the same end point. And actually, that's not necessarily the case anymore. It may be, and you know, we've been talking about it, particularly in terms of security and defense. I think it's one can talk about it in terms of the euro. Yes, there was this understanding, and on paper there still is this understanding that everyone's going to eventually join the euro, but that's fantasy. And And it's clear. So actually, I think we're moving towards a multi-level rather than multi-speed. The question is whether these these different levels across different policy fields overlap or perfectly overlap. Now, certainly there will be a group of member states that is likely to be in everything. So it's likely to be in a PESCO, in a Eurozone, in Schengen, and eventually in, if you like, deeper integration, particularly when it comes to migration and asylum policy. So there will be a hard core, but then there will be fuzzy edges. Take the case of Sweden. I imagine that if there were to be deeper integration in the area of migration and asylum, well, Sweden is likely to be in it. Would I imagine Sweden to be in a PESCO? Frankly, not really.
Ireland, I wanted to ask.
So then the question is, if there are going to be these fuzzy edges to this multi-level EU, how do you govern them? You know, what are the institutional implications? And these are the huge question marks, I think, that we now face. And as I said, it'd be simpler if it was simply two levels across different policy fields. But I don't think that's the reality that we're moving into.
I'm surprised that principled pragmatism came up, because even though I think it was more or less supposed to be the bumper sticker, few people are talking about it, and everybody talks about resilience. I don't like resilience, but I've bored Natalie many times with it already, so I won't do that now. But I do like principled pragmatism, and I think in this end, I really like the strategy, trying to sort of find the middle course between over-optimistic idealism and pure power politics, which would just not be right and also unfeasible. So I think it's a really good attempt to find this middle course. I've been thinking about this recently because, the EU is not intending to be another classic great power, right? But we do want to be a power, I think. I mean, an actor that has influence, that can achieve its objectives. But what is our story? What do we seek for other countries? And I would say, ideally, what we want other countries to be is not necessarily resilient. I mean, if you ask me what is my purpose in life, I will not say, I would like to be resilient. There's other things that I would like to get, which I probably won't get, but that's another story. I think what we have to... I see as our objective is that one is every nation should enjoy full sovereignty, right? They don't have to choose to be the best friends of us, but they should not be forced to be the best friends of somebody else. It should be their own free choice. Yeah. So we support everybody's sovereignty and autonomy. And for me, the other notion, which I like more than resilience, is equality. I think what makes Europe is the egalitarian aspiration. If you want someone slightly more authoritative than me who said that, read Tony Judd, post-war. Mm. And at the end of his book, when he asked himself, what is Europe? He says, Europe is the social model. And I think that can be a source of attractiveness and soft power, and you can play on different levels of equality in different countries. On German leadership, I think Belgium is ready for German leadership, but that may say a lot about us. I'm not sure about that. Dangerous to go there, so I won't. I think German leadership is fine, as long as if it's not German-only leadership, but it has to be also German leadership. Yeah. Otherwise, it doesn't work. So, I mean, I annoy a lot of people in various debates here by saying, in a way, you know, the UK, in good old-fashioned geopolitical terms, is peripheral to the European project. The core of the European project and the purpose was the Franco-German reconciliation. So as long as the Germans and the French want ever closer union is what we're going to get. I think the Germans still want it, and we'll know soon enough whether the French still want it. I'm just really, really happy that the French have this two-stage election system. And on multi-speed, I just agree with everything that Natalie said.
That was easy.
Perfect. Yeah, on principled pragmatism, I'm a great believer in plain text readings. So just reverse it. If it was pragmatic principles, I'd have a problem. Principled pragmatism, I'm all on board. That's not a problem. In terms of German leadership, I particularly I'm struck by Natalie's point. It is not so much German leadership as the absence of other leaders. And for me, the gaping hole of the scenario was obviously France. Yeah. We've been missing French leadership for an awfully long time. It would be wonderful to think that we would get from the French elections a strong French president who had a European, strong European vocation, which would address the multi-speed, multi-level issue, because it is and always has been the Franco-German motor. It goes back to the very essence of what the European Union was designed to resolve. And in the absence of French leadership, you know, we are left with a reliance on the redoubtable figure of Angela Merkel. But my hope and prayer, frankly, would be that we would have French leadership, and with French leadership in that Franco-German condominium, if it requires a stronger core, which might increase the variegation and the heterogeneity of the Union, but with a stronger central core between France and Germany, then I think many of the issues that we're concerned about dealing with in respect of Hungary, in respect of Poland, in respect of other member states, you know, I'd have greater confidence and less fear, which is all I'm aspiring to at the moment.
Did you want to say something about multi-speed?
Yeah, that was the Franco-German motor. I mean, if that was to acquire something more profound in terms of European unification at the core, I have no problem with either multi-speed or multi-level, and allow people not on an a la carte basis, but on the basis of clear structures and clear levels of responsibility. Maybe Brexit, you know, again, in the most Hollywood kind of scenario, maybe Brexit might reveal some kind of new relationship that can be arrived at with a former member state. I have my serious doubts, but that's also a possibility in terms of things like continental partnership and other things that we've heard of over recent months.
All right. Okay. I think we've got time for one last round of questions. All right. We have pink shirt. Gentleman and then the gentleman in the front.
Hello. Hi, this is Sara Poli from Italy. Hello. I have a question for Natalie on the intriguing notion of principal pragmatism. I understand very well the definition that you gave of the first limb of this expression, which is pragmatism. I understand less the second limb, principle. It seems to me that there is an overlap between the principle of consistency between the internal and external action and your definition of principled pragmatism. So that's the first comment. And the second comment is, if we have to abide by the principled pragmatism, then does this mean that the EU will give up to political conditionality in its relations with the countries? Are we going to delete all the essential element clauses on human rights in association agreements and all of this? Thank you.
Gentleman right here. Atar Hassan from LSE. Could the panel comment on the possibility that Brexit may be followed by a not unlikely possibility of the United Kingdom transforming itself from a divided kingdom?
Scotland, right? Yes.
Hi, my name is Tracy. I'm from the University of Westminster, and I study Arabic with international relations, so this was really, really interesting to come and see. One of the questions that I have is, what would the EU need to be or do if Trump was to take an individual kind of strategy and had a partnership with Russia? How would the EU defend itself, or if it would need to defend itself?
Okay, great. I think I'm going to take one more question because you all were wonderfully brief. I'll go on this side. And she's glasses right there. Yep.
Thank you. One of the most effective strategies devised and implemented by the European Union have not been labeled as such a strategy. So what do you think that this global strategy will bring to the table, especially if we think about the critiques brought to the European security strategy and to the implementation report? Thank you.
All right.
Okay. On principled pragmatism. Well, look, what I would say on this is, so what are the principles? When it comes to foreign policy, we say that we, and most of our constitutions say, that we have to respect international law. If we have to live up to our democratic principles in relation to foreign policy, this is what we have to do. Well, we're bound by it, by law. I would say if only we were to actually do it, and do it consistently, that would be more than enough. Well, not more than enough, but it would be sufficient. I would feel, you know, happy and confident about a European Union that it can actually say it has a principled foreign policy if it were to do that. I care less about what the EU says, and at times it says a bit too much. So when it talks democracy and democratization too much, and it actually never ends up doing it, that's where the inconsistency comes in. So my point is, stop over-talking, start doing more of the action, and if you have to be selective in the action, because the world is big, bad, and ugly, and you will not have liberal democracies popping up left, right, and center, just stick to what you really do have to do to live up to your own democratic principles, and that's basically international law, which of course includes human rights and humanitarian law. I mean, it's not exclusive, but it includes those two bits. It does not include, for instance, the fact that countries need to have elections as a first step. So I would say, you know, go back to basics. Go back to basics and do what really matters if you want to actually live up to your own internal principles and therefore be more consistent in your internal and your external policies. I leave the divided kingdom to Ben. Trump. Okay. Obviously, this is, you know, at this point, pure speculation, but we may as well.
Why not?
So if there were to be a Trump partnership with Russia, what would this mean for the European Union? Well, I would say it depends on where that partnership is and what it's on. Well, firstly, a sort of observation before all this. And the observation is that if we were to simply listen to what Trump has said up until now, partnership is not a word that comes up very often. It's more about the deals. So there's sort of transactional deals that he does bit by bit and issue by issue. So I cannot imagine a Trump forging a partnership with Russia, which would span across different areas, other than perhaps having a certain chemistry between strong men that may lead to deals being easier to forge on different issues. But if we were to look at what these different deals may look like, I would have thought that when it comes to the Middle East, it is slightly less problematic. But this is assuming that a deal between Trump and Mr. Putin would basically go in the direction of a slightly more isolationist, if you like, US when it comes to the Middle East specifically. Does that mean that the Middle East is going to look like a great place? No. Does a more interventionist US promise to make the Middle East better? No. So, I mean, you know, we're talking about bad and worse, really. So I would say, but when it comes specifically to the Middle East, I wouldn't feel particularly worried about some sort of deal when it comes to whatever, Syria. Because the alternative is as worse, if not much worse. When it comes to Eastern Europe, and in particular Ukraine, and not only Ukraine, and the future of NATO, then that's, I think, far more serious for Europeans. Because here we're basically talking about a deal which would presumably leave Eastern Europe, but basically tell, you know, Russia, do what you want, you know, in Eastern Europe. This is really none of our business, which obviously would put Europeans in a very difficult spot. And it would put Europeans in a difficult spot in different ways, but I would say that of the many difficulties that it would create, it would create a huge division, I think, within the European Union. Because deep down, there will be some member states that will probably think, you know what, they're probably right. You know, those member states that tend to be more, if you like, pro-Russian. Of course, others would be completely freaked out by this. So my fear, I mean, beyond obviously the fear for, you know, Ukraine and Georgia and Moldova, so beyond the, you know, what the deal is actually about, my fear about the impact that it would have on the European Union is that it would basically reignite those divisions that have been, which are still there and kind of latent, and that have been very, you know, sort of through excruciating talks and negotiations, finally one's come to a position which may not be 100% coherent, but it's still something, which is basically, I think, what we managed to achieve between 2014 and now on Russia. My fear is that a deal between Trump and Putin would simply reawaken all of those divisions.
Great. And if I can ask you to take 2 minutes each.
On principled pragmatism, I want to underline Natalie's point, the importance of living up ourselves internally to our principles, because I think we often underestimate how crucial this is for our image abroad and thus for the credibility of our foreign policy initiatives. I always offer the same anecdotal evidence. Every year I teach this course on EU foreign policy in Beijing. I don't need to try and impress my Chinese students with Europe's military might, not with its diplomatic might, not even with its economic power, because they know they're somewhat biggish themselves in economic terms. But what they do know is that Europe is a nice place to live, and that our governments take much better care of us than their governments of them, right? As I always tell them, Belgium is closer, much closer to communism than China. And they know that. But of course, the moment we no longer live up to our own principles, then whatever you're going to propose outside, someone will say, well, we're not doing it yourselves.
Exactly.
Why would we?
Exactly.
On the disunited kingdom, speaking as a citizen of another one, my only consolation that I can offer is that a country can keep falling apart for a long time before it actually does. So don't despair. On Trump and Russia, I don't know why everybody or many people are so negative about the prospect that we would reach a deal with Russia. I thought that's what we would have been trying to do. And that's why Kerry and Lavrov are negotiating all the time. It just irritates me that we are not there, we the Europeans, I mean. We're not at that table. I think we already knew that if there would be any deal on Syria, it will be a deal with Assad in place, unfortunately. But that's what Putin already assured, quite regardless of Trump's victory, through his military intervention. So we also know that whatever happens in Ukraine, the Crimea will not return to Ukraine. So I think elements of the deal are in place. The main problem is that Putin seems to think it's more in his interest to keep the unrest in eastern Ukraine going than to make a deal. Though I think he's reaching the point where it's no longer in his interest to continue the war in Syria, because he has what he wants anyway. But Assad may not have all what he has wanted. So as long as any deal don't mean a total sellout with regard to the Eastern Partnership countries, I think it could be beneficial.
Mm. I'll limit myself to reply to 2 points. One on the divided kingdom. Obviously, it's not just your problem. It's also ours on the other side of the Irish Sea. And I have been deeply disappointed and in many senses shocked by the extent to which British policymakers have been promising things on the border on the island of Ireland that they know they cannot deliver, mm-hmm. that are wholly and utterly inconsistent with everything they say in another context regarding Brexit and what it would look like in the shape of it. Mm-hmm. To promise us no borders and at the same time talking about leaving the customs union, yeah. and having immigration controls, I mean, what do they expect happens at a border? I mean, for people who were so consumed with their sovereignty of their borders to say that, oh, we want a border here, but screw it, we don't want a border there, the logic of that utterly escapes me. And it has serious implications. And I wouldn't over-dramatize in terms of the security situation, but we've worked bloody hard since 1994 yeah. to create a security situation which has allowed some semblance of normal political development on the other side of the Irish border and to create some sense of stability. And for people to play around with that yeah. in terms of what would go on the Irish border, I think is frankly unconscionable. So it's not just your problem. It is certainly ours. Just very briefly then on Russia, US, and I agree with everything that has been said previously. I would only add one thing. You know, the European Union, notwithstanding our ambitions in terms of common security defense policy, is not going to replace NATO. So therefore, what Russia fears is not so much our hard power. What Russia fears is the European Union's soft power. What Putin fears, has feared, and does fear, mm-hmm. Is a colored revolution yeah. in Moscow. That is the origin, the yeah. epicenter of everything he has done geostrategically with respect to Ukraine, Crimea, Transnistria in terms of Georgia, etc., etc., etc. So in a sense, I worry less about the European Union developing its capacity in terms of hard power, and much more that the European Union would remain true to its soft power, which I think in the medium to longer term is our guarantor both of our own security and the freedom, justice, and liberty of others in Europe.
Well, on that note, I think we can...